Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Cellular Healing TV, episode 68. This is David Asarno, and I am here with Dr. Pompa. Good morning, Dr. Pompa.
Good morning.
Can you believe, last week we were talking about 67. It's just so hard to believe we've been doing this show for 68 episodes, and it's fantastic at the same time.
Absolutely. It's amazing how it's caught on, you know. This show was, we originally just said, we want to bring our message out there. It'll help SEO, and then, here we are, not many shows.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You look at it. We've got, you know, tens of thousands of podcast followers now that are listening to what we have every single week.
Yeah. Hey, David, we actually started this. Do you remember where it was in that hotel? Of course, this was your idea.
I remember.
Was that Tampa or Atlanta? Where was that?
It was Tampa, and it's when I had a really bad fever.
Yeah, okay, I didn't even know that. Anyways, I was sitting outside, and, we did the show.
Oh, wait, that was in Charlotte, the first hangout that we did.
Charlotte.
It was right after one of our masterminds with a bunch of the doctors in the program, we launched that. But here's the great thing. We get to not only talk about, you know, the real truth, the 180-degree solution, and the things that people need to do, we also get to have special guests on. We get to hear what they went through and what changed their life. And people get to hear, oh, I can identify with that. I've got things like that going on too. And why don't you introduce today's guests?
Yeah, well, it's I almost said Dr. Kevin Rail. But
I'm okay being called doctor. I got no problem with that.
But at least on Cellular Healing TV.
He is well, Kevin, how would you say yourself? An exercise? I almost said exercise.
I like to use the word tacticianer, to be honest with you.
Oh, I love that, and especially if you saw what Kevin did. But look, I mean, today you're going to hear a little bit about some of the really unique stuff that Kevin takes his people through. And my wife is one of his people. But, you know, I think the thing that I really love about Kevin the most is y'all out there know that I love a good story. I believe that the story, the adversity, I should say, makes the man and the woman. And Kevin has an amazing, amazing story. And I asked Kevin to share that story with you this morning. And, of course, he will share some of his ideas. He's going to give you some exercise things out there that we'll talk a little bit about. I don't know what we could give them today, but maybe you can think of something. But anyways, so hang in there. We're going to give you some really cool what you call neuro load. I call it neuromuscular exercises that, really, some of which you've come up with yourself, Kevin. You're a pretty amazing innovator. So, well, anyways, with that said, Kevin, welcome. And I want to hear your story. But first, I have to ask this question to our audience. How many of you have ever heard of orthorexia? Orthorexia. Well, probably not that many. David, have you heard of it before?
No, I didn't. And when I saw that, Kevin, you were going to be a guest on the show today, I Googled you and I found your website and I started reading your story. By the way, the whole story about wanting to be a professional wrestler, I remember when I was a kid, my dad brought me, you know, jumping on beds, sitting there tackling each other, throwing people, body slamming. So, you know, it's like I'm reading your story and I'm like, hey, I remember that when I was a kid. I just never took it in. And then my son wanted to do that, but that's a whole other story. But, I never heard about it until I went to your website and I started reading about it. And it is something unique. And I think it's something that many people probably experience. And one of the things that you wrote about was, you know, eating disorders, especially for men, are underreported and misdiagnosed.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Kevin, share with us. What is orthorexia? But more importantly, tell us your story.
Okay. Well, I'll define orthorexia first before we get any further. To put it simply, it's a fixation on righteous eating. That's kind of the technical scientific definition of it, if you want to just summarize it quickly. In the big picture, it's a flat-out eating disorder. There's no two ways around it. I have this like over fixation on food, basically, is how it boils down to. Several years ago, it was 2008. It was like July or August, I would say, of 2008. I'm 6'3", first of all. I got down to 145 pounds, and I was totally ready to go down to 140 pounds, and I just kept challenging myself to see if I can go farther and farther and farther. So basically, what orthorexia is we all three of us on this call right now, We're all healthy eaters. We all live the organic lifestyle, and we're all into it. And we spread the word. We spread the message. We motivate as many people as we can. But there comes a time where that road gets a little bit bumpy, and the clouds start rolling in, and things start getting a little hazy. And what happens is you cross this line where you become obsessed. Basically, it's great to eat healthy and worry about high fructose corn syrup and all those other things and GMOs and the whole nine yards. But you also can flip a switch and go too far to a point where you become alienated from society, where all you do is think about food and how many calories you're taking in, how many calories you're burning every single day. And then you start worrying about, oh my gosh, if I go to this party, there might be cupcakes there, there might be alcohol there. And you start talking yourself out of going to public places and going out with friends and going to birthday parties and going to fairs and going to picnics because you think you have an opportunity of cheating. And you get guilty, majorly guilty, and then the next day you get up earlier in the morning than normal, you work out extra, and then you cut your calories down even more. And back in 2008, the summer, I had a perfect game plan set up. I would get up at 20 to 5 in the morning. I'd get to the gym at 20 to 5 when it opened at 5. I had an insider who worked there who let me in early. I would do 90 minutes worth of interval training on a treadmill. I'd get off, take a shower quickly. I would eat my oatmeal, which I had perfectly portioned out. I knew exactly how many calories was in it. I had 1 tablespoon of this, 1 tablespoon of that, a pinch of that, a little squirt of agave syrup on top. 210 calories, I was good to go. I had it memorized. Then I'd go upstairs happy, train 3 clients, run back home, have another small meal, hop on my bike, go for a 2.5-hour bike ride, get to the point where I was about to pass out, stop at a health food store, which I really like, called Fairweather Foods in Park City. If you ever go there, check it out. I would get a banana and 2 of these little sesame treats and a coconut water, and then I'd get another 250 calories or whatever, and I was literally on the verge of passing out when I hit that spot, and I made sure that I got to that point while riding in the 95-degree heat every single day. And then all of a sudden, I was like Superman. I was like Clark Kent jumping into a phone booth and getting recharged again. I was like, bam, my electrolytes hit back in. I was like, ooh, I got all this energy. So then I'd fly home, which is another 7 miles, take another shower. And the first thing I would do is I'd go on the computer, and I'd open up this caloric expenditure website, and I'd punch in all my data, all my information, my height, my weight, and everything. Literally, this happened every single day in the summer of 2008.
Wow.
From June until the end of August. And I found out that I was burning 1,600 calories a day, and I made it an effort to burn 1,400, to only consume 1,400 calories a day. So it then became my obsession to burn more calories than I was consuming. And if a day went by that I was unable to do that, I would go into like, I would just flip out. It was almost like a roid rage, although I was never on steroids. I don't buy into that stuff at all. But it's very similar to that. My mood swings were up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. So I got to 150 pounds, and I'm like, I'm going to 145. It just became like my obsession and my goal to keep losing weight and keep getting, as I would just say, lean and ripped, lean and ripped, lean and ripped. But in reality, I had a massive eating disorder beyond belief. And every one of my friends and colleagues saw it. My clients saw it. Everyone in town did. And they tried to allude me to it all the time. And I was just like, you know, it's just like an alcoholic who doesn't believe they're an alcoholic. You're in complete denial. It's right. Very similar to alcoholism. So I was completely out of control. And then one day I just got fed up with everyone pointing fingers at me and saying I had a problem and all this stuff. And I'm like, I'm going to show all you people. I'm packing my crap and I'm moving to New York City and I'm going to pitch this show to Spike TV and I'm going to be internationally known. You're all going to regret ever saying a word to me. Because you start having all these crazy thoughts too. So you're very unsettled, you're very disheveled, and you're all over the place. And basically your hormones are all over the place too because your body fat percentage starts getting so low. Your brain starts getting decomposed for energy. And you're just like a huge hot mess. That's all that there is to it. One minute you're really happy, next minute you're really depressed, next minute you're really sad, next minute you're suicidal. So I basically flatlined when I was out in Manhattan because it occurred around September 20th or something like that. Matter of fact, Dan, I just found an old journal I had sitting back in my storage cabinet from 2008, and every day I'd like read a few things in it, and I saw this journal entry that said 145 pounds, 3 exclamation points, so excited. It was like September 20th, 2008. Can't wait to go for 140.
Wow.
So it was literally September 20th when I completely hit the wall mentally.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. It was pretty rough.
To me, like, you know, I look at, you know, an exercise guy, you know, now you're filled with muscle and everything. To me, it just defies, like, logic of what I would think a guy like you would want. Like, why would a guy like you want to get, you know, skinnier? Because that means less muscle, and yet you're working out. Like, why was the goal less weight? And I know it makes no logical sense, but I have to ask that question anyway.
Well, I felt like the only way that I can achieve a lean, muscular, ripped body is by sacrificing weight. That's really kind of how what it boiled down to. Then it just became like this goal and obsession to try to lose weight because it almost became like a game to me. I'm like, oh, I wonder if I can get to 145. Oh, maybe I can get to 140. Wow, wow, I wonder if I get to 135 even. And I just kept on trying to push myself. It's like, because I didn't have anything specifically I was training for. A lot of people are, especially in our town, Dan, you know, they're enduros, and they do like 5Ks all the time, triathlons, all these other things. I was training for something. But there was no goal for me. It was just like, hey, I'm going to just do it for fun. But the fun ended up being, it turned ugly, and I got way out of control. And then I realized, I started sifting back through my years growing up, and it all started as a child. And it just went forward and forward, and it went unrecognizable until literally 2008. And that's finally when I realized what was going on and what was happening. And I literally had this condition ever since I was probably 5 years old.
You know, Kevin, that's what I wanted to talk about, now, you know, because I believe there's a cause for everything. Certain stresses happen in our life, and then we end up with things later in life, right? That's every client that I have. I always go back to when things started, because that's the key. So I want you to go back to that time. However, your brother played a big role in waking you up. Tell us about that.
Okay, well, finally I got to a point when I was in Manhattan. I went over to a client's house who lived over by the East River. And this is at around that time, around September 20th or so. I was completely, at this point, I was physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually bankrupt. I mean, I was ready to just jump in. I literally was ready to die, and I didn't care. I remember working out in the mornings. I was living in this really dumpy apartment over in Edgewater, New Jersey, and I had to take the bus into Manhattan every day. And I was struggling big time with my finances, with bills. I had a mortgage back in Pennsylvania that a house I rented, and I was way late on that. They were going to, whatever, foreclose on it. And I was just like, I was so done. It was unbelievable. And I remember exercising in my bedroom in the mornings, and just every time I would do like a crunch, I had this medicine ball. I remember I'd hold up behind my back, and I'd do like a pullover crunch, and I'd sit up. And every time I'd come up, I'd be like, God, just kill me. God, just kill me. And I just kept asking God to kill me. Literally, that's how bad I was. And it was awful. And then I would just get up, and I'd be like, I'd send someone an email right before I'd go over to hit the bus stop. I'd be like, I'm going to Manhattan today. Hopefully, I'll get hit by a bus that gets out of control, or hopefully I'll get shot by some kind of gang warfare, and you'll never have to worry about me again and all this stuff, because I know I'm a big burden on you guys. And I would say messages like this to my friends. I mean, I was out there. I was gone.
You were reaching out, though.
Yeah, I was reaching out in a disturbed way, but I was doing it. And then I went over to Manhattan this one day in the middle of the afternoon. It was right around that time frame, and I was standing on the handrail of the East River, and it was cooking. There was a lot of rain before that. It was in December, I think. And it looked like chocolate milk, and it was booking really hard, and it was really high, and it was like this big concrete drop-off going down to it. And I was looking down at that water, and I said to myself, I wonder if I could survive if I jumped in the water. It was like, it wasn't like I was suicidal, but I was just, I was to a point where I just didn't care about living anymore. I was in this like gray area where everything just was like flowing, and I just didn't care. And I'm like, I don't care if I make it out alive. I wonder if I could do it though. And if I can do it, then I can do anything, and I could turn myself around and all this stuff. I had weird thoughts like that flowing through my head all day long, right until the time I went to bed. So it was really hard to do. And right at that point when I was about to jump off, my friend Jessica called me from back in Pennsylvania, because she was one of the recipients of one of my disturbing emails. And she's like, what's wrong with you? Blah, 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 blah. And she started nutting up on me, and I was all like, I said, I don't really need to be around anymore. You guys get along without me. And she just started crying, and she started screaming. And she's like, think of how your mother would be if you left and all this stuff and everything else. And she made me feel guilty, and I hate feeling guilty. So she talked me off the ledge. I sat down in a chair. I talked to her for a little while, and I was like, well, I'm coming back to PA tomorrow. This is enough. I got to get out of New York City, first of all. So when I came back home, my brother had come up from Washington, D.C., and he throws this pack of information in front of me, and on the top it said orthorexia nervosa. He goes, and he points at it, he goes, you have that. And my brother and I, we never really saw eye to eye that well. We get along, but he's always been kind of sarcastic to me and a bit of a nut breaker, if you will. And he was kind of being sarcastic with me. So I'm trying to keep a PG here. So he throws that paper on the table. He's like, you have that. So I'm like, what are you talking about? And I kind of got in this little argument with him, and I looked at it, and although he was being sarcastic, he was 100% on the money. So I looked at this paper, and it said orthorexia nervosa. And I read all the way through it, and then I started writing this article on eating disorders when I was working for this company called Demand Media Studios, and I had to do research on it. And combined with what it said on that paper and all the research I had done from CDC and all the other websites out there on eating disorders, I wrote this article, I put it out there, it got accepted, and then it got put out in the cyberspace. And I realized I had 90% of the symptoms of the eating disorders, plus one probably. And then finally it struck me, and I was like, oh my gosh. I'm like, the big aha moment finally hit me. And I realized I was completely 100% eating disordered, and I needed to turn things around, or I was going to pass out and die. Because one of the symptoms when you have an eating disorder is your body fat gets so low that your organs just start shutting down randomly with no rhyme or reason, no questions, nothing. It's like you'll be sitting there talking, I'll be talking to you, and then all of a sudden my liver stops like that, and then I'm gone.
Yeah.
And that's what happens. And that kind of woke me up finally. And then that's when I started making my transition right there.
Yeah. Okay, before we let, we'll talk about your transition, let's go back to age five, you know? I mean,
okay.
You know, what were the stressors that caused it?
Well, my father was he was old school, and he was old-fashioned, big time. He grew up on a farm, and he was all about not exercising per se, but, like, staying healthy and staying fit and always doing chores around the farm and stuff like that. And he kind of tried to make me and my brother do that as we grew up. And, of course, we're kids, and we're resistant, and we want to play Atari, and we don't want to go out and pick rocks out of the garden. That's a bunch of crap. So we were at odds with them, with my parents growing up. But one thing that stuck in my head is he was always, like, he would joke with us sometimes, and he'd say, oh, you guys have pot bellies. You got to get rid of that pot belly, jokingly. And I took that to heart. I mean, you're 5 years old. How impressionable is a five-year-old? Just like a puppy. If you kick a puppy's going to think you're an idiot its whole life when it grows up. And it's not that my father was an idiot, but he was just trying to instill good habits in us. But as a child, that's not how you think. And I'm a very emotional person, and I attach to things really probably more than the average person does. And at 5 years old, I'm thinking, oh, I can't have a pot belly. I don't want to disgrace my father. I don't want to let him down. So I was always just like, I made sure, like, I exercised all the time, and I worked hard, extra hard with every single thing I did. And then sometimes I'd sit at the table at school when I was eating lunch, and I would suck my stomach in the whole time I sat there because I was afraid kids were going to look at me and point at me and laugh and say I had a pot belly. And, I mean, I'm serious. That went on for years, 6th grade, 7th grade, 8th grade. I would literally sit upright, and I would suck my stomach in, and I would eat really slow and, like, really weird. And never, no one ever really noticed it or said anything to me about it, but it happened, and it was going on. And it all started when I was, like, 5. And those kind of habits just kept on accumulating as I got older and older until finally 2008 they all culminated. So that's kind of how it all kicked off.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, I mean, just thinking of that, you know, it's like it's how many – I mean, it just shows you how, as humans, how frail sometimes we really are, right? I mean, we look back at our childhood, and it's just – it's amazing what comes out of it, you know. And, you know, that was a stressor, and that was something that set up a mindset that now has affected you years later. So anyways, okay, so how did you transition out, man? I mean, there's people watching this, I promise you, that have, you know, they're going through this. I mean, somehow, some way, you know, they're relating to this conversation going, oh, crap, you know, maybe this is me. Because, you know, a lot of the clients that I see, Kevin, you know, they get there for other reasons too, right? They get there because they were so sick, and, you know, and then they start getting fearful about certain things, and it sets up these patterns. And, you know, I've seen this so many times different ways. How did you get out?
Well, for me, it was a long process. First of all, I want to say this to all the people out there. The male population is very underserved when it comes to eating disorders. It's shocking to know that there's as many men out there, in my opinion, that have eating disorders as women. They just don't know it, or they don't realize it, and it's a macho thing. Like, I denied it for years, and I'm like, oh, men don't have eating disorders. That's a bunch of crap. I don't believe it. But in reality, once I put all the pieces together and thought back in hindsight, it is absolutely true. Men have them just as much as women. It's just that we don't come forth and say it because we're afraid we're going to be judged or looked at weird, or people are going to say things to us, or like, oh, you have an eating disorder, and laugh at us or something like that. But it's not that case at all. It's just like people who are afraid to go to a gym because they think everyone's going to stare at them and look at them, and that's not the case at all. If you feel you have an eating disorder of any kind, you need to just come right out and say it and come clean with it, and you got to find a circle of people that you know and trust to talk to about it. Because I've spoken down at the U about this before, and that's usually the question I get from students and everything, like, how did you recognize it, and what do you do about it? Because I might know someone who does. And it's always the might know someone who does is actually them, but I can tell by their eyes, but you know how it works. What I did is exactly that. I have a very good network of close friends back in Northeast Pennsylvania that always have supported me and have helped me, and they're big into organic food and eating and spirituality and the whole nine yards, but they know how to do it right. And they all basically cornered me. Basically, I guess it was a intervention, if you will. And they said, you look absolutely sick. They said, you look like you have rickets. And I went like this, my eyebrow went near, and I'm like, rickets? I'm like, last time I heard the word rickets was on an episode of Little House on the Prairie, I think, years ago. And they're like, I'm like, does that even exist anymore? And so my friend's like, yeah, you look like you have rickets. Your eyes are, your cheeks are all sunken in. Your eyes are black and blue. It looks like you got beat up. It looks like you haven't slept in weeks. And they basically came out and told me, like, it's your eating habits. You got to change it or you're going to die. And then basically all that happened the exact same time that my brother handed me that paper and I was writing articles and doing the research, and it all happened exactly at the same time.
God was looking at me.
Exactly. It was like God just went boom, just dropped all this stuff right in my lap at the same exact moment. I was like, oh my gosh. And then I'm like, I started thinking about hypocrisy, and there's so many, Dan, you could probably easily attest to this, how many hypocrites and charlatans there are in our industry, fitness and wellness. And I'm like, one thing I pride myself in is being a straight-up gunslinger, and I practice what I preach every single day of the week. I walk the walk, and I talk the talk. And if I'm sitting here with a massive eating disorder, and I'm writing articles on eating disorders and telling people how to get help and how to get changed and fixed and all these other things, and I'm not doing it myself, then I'm a hypocrite. So it was partially that really propelled me forward. And then I started worrying about my mom and everything, and because my father passed away when I was 19 from cancer, which was also a big motivator for me to start my whole like super healthy trend. And I just took it one day at a time, and I realized I'm going to disappoint a lot of people, a lot more people if I die or kill myself than if I stick around. So I just decided I got to make this happen. I got to change. So one day at a time is all I took it. And literally, I just got up in the morning, and I'm like, I have to accept the fact that I'm going to gain some weight. And the hardest part is a lot of it is an image disorder. It's not. It's dysmorphia. You look in the mirror and you say to yourself, oh, my God, I need to get rid of this fat on my side. But you're just pinching skin. So you have to get – you have to basically accept yourself for who you are and what you are and what you will become. And that's usually the hardest thing that anyone in the whole world has with anything at all. So I just took it one day at a time, and I was like, I need to start increasing my calories. And I had a support system of like 5 to 10 people deep that I could text or call or just knock on the door any hour of any day. If I didn't have that support system, I wouldn't have been able to do it alone. I would have had to absolutely get into a clinic. And I've spoken to people at some of my talks before about eating disorders, and they came afterward and told me, oh, yeah, you know, you're so motivating and stuff. And I had an eating disorder myself, and I had to go to a clinic and everything. And like, did you go to a clinic? And I was like, no. And they gave me a little backstory of their situation. And I've spoken to people whose situations were like one-tenth as bad as mine, who had to go to clinics for like 6 months, 8 months, 10 months. And most people are pretty shocked that I didn't go myself. And I, now that I look back at it, I'm pretty shocked as well. So yeah. It was just a daily, it was a daily grind to get back into the swing. And it took me probably a good year and a half before I got to what I would consider a more normal weight. And I went from like 145 to like 190, like 195 or something like that. Right now, about 190, I'm hovering around.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Kevin, I have to ask this question because, you know, you're in the industry too, and you know a lot about this because you experienced it. Is the opposite, do you see the opposite happen where you see a kid who is, you know, ultra skinny and then all they want to do is, you know, put muscle on, right? I mean, it's like, and it becomes this obsession. I mean, obviously that could lead to even steroids, but let's say it doesn't. I mean, it just can become this obsession because, you know, I mean, it's, you know, honestly, it's like when, you know, I was a kid, I was like, you know, I never wanted to be that skinny kid, so that interested me in exercise. I mean, fortunately, it didn't get to be the obsessive thing, but, you know, I have my one son, you know, he just doesn't want to be looked at as the skinny kid, right? He's got my genetics, you know, so he just wants to put on muscle. I worry about that. I worry about him. I worry about, you know, do you see that as a problem? I mean, do you see it the other way, meaning that lose weight, do people go obsessive gaining weight?
I think people will go both directions. I think obsession is a big thing when it comes to body image and aestheticness and all those other things. High school kids, I remember several years back when, what was that supplement called? Everybody was doing it. Muscle Tech was like the big thing. And you go to gyms, you see kids 15, 16, 17 years old just shaking these shakers up, slamming this Muscle Tech stuff left and right every time you turn around. And all they think about is getting bigger, that's all they could think about. And that is actually called bigorexia, so there is a name for that too, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen that. I mean, I've seen this happen. I mean, all the way to steroids, all the way to the where it literally dominates their life to where they are this odd person that, you know, like, who are you and what have you become?
Yeah, it's definitely, interestingly, most of the time in that age group, it is about looking good and impressing chicks. I mean, that's the 15, 18 years old, guys are out to impress chicks. Let's be honest here. They want the fancy car. They want the nice hat on backwards and sideways, gold grill in their mouth and the whole nine yards, and they want the big muscles to match.
Right.
And it can become an obsession all the way up to steroids, and that could be a huge problem.
Yeah.
So it's definitely there. But usually in the eating disorder side of the story, where deprivation is the case, it has nothing to do with food at all, like zero. Exactly. It has everything to do with like inside issues. It's like feeling of inadequacy. It's being bullied, being like overlooked or looked down upon. I mean, I had all those emotions growing up. And when I look back on it, that's exactly what I did. I channeled my aggression of anger or disgust or hatred or whatever into exercise and into fitness and into eating and so on and so forth and cutting my calories. And it was always like, I'll show them, I'll do extra reps. I'll show them, I'll get ripped. I'll show them, I'll become a fitness model. I'll show them, I'll have my own TV show. And it just went on and on and on. The list just keeps going. So it became, that all started occurring to me as I started eating more food and getting my brain level back to where it should be. Because literally within, after about a week or so of increasing my calorie intake, my brain function started to come back and get better again. I guess when you start feeding the brain, it works wonders, huh?
Well, the brain needs fat, man. You know, and you bought into something that we don't buy into. I know you don't, but you bought into caloric restriction. You know, I hate that word. You know,
yeah,
you bought into low fat. I hate that word too, right? But yeah, I mean, the brain needs fat, man. You know, and you were literally starving your brain. You know, I mean, it really is remarkable when you hear the extremes. You know, a lot of it, I've read, I've heard, is about control, meaning that, you find this one area, and you said, I wanted to just do this, I wanted to just that. You can control this area. You know, I mean, how much do you think it is just simply about this one area of your life that you're able to control because other areas you weren't able to control? I mean, or is it just, about, just these wounds that we get as a child?
I say it's 99% about control.
Yeah.
That's a good point you brought up, because it always boils down to that in the end. I don't have any control of what's going to happen at work today. I don't have any control of what's going to happen when I get in my car. I'm not going to have any control of what happens when I walk into the bookstore to buy a book. However, I can control every single morsel of food that goes in my mouth and every single drop of liquid calories I consume. And I can eat lavishly, I can eat hungrily, I can eat like a prince or a pauper or a queen or a champ, or I can cut my calories any which way I see fit. So one thing I don't have control over is if someone's going to laugh at me or say I have big ears or call me a name or something today. However, I do have control of what I'm going to eat the rest of the day. So if someone makes fun of me and calls me a name, I can restrict my calories and I can get on my bike and I can do 50 miles today and feel good about it. And it's almost like it's like a self-medication.
And
that's how I looked at it.
And that's where the I'll show them thing comes from, right?
Yes.
I'll show them.
Yeah.
Huh.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's amazing. David, you probably have some questions. I've been dominating the questions.
A few. I mean, here's the thing, and I think you've said it multiple times. It's our love of ourself, and whether or not someone's going to say something, call us a name, or say that we've got a funky looking shirt on or whatever, it doesn't really matter. It's how we react to it, and.
Right.
But here's a question that was going through my mind while you're telling your story. Okay, you've got this group of five people around you. You realize that there's a challenge, and it's kind of interesting. Part of your control is being able to turn it off as well and make a decision. Okay, now I'm going in this direction, and I'm going to get my life back, and I'm going to change. How did you change your exercise pattern when you started eating more? Did you continue exercising like you were before?
Well, that's interesting. I have not missed a day of exercise since September 30th of 2007.
Okay.
I found out Jack LaLanne exercised 57 years straight, 2.5 hours a day. And I said to myself, wow, that's impressive. So one day I decided, well, I'm going to exercise every single day the rest of my life for a minimum of 30 minutes. And it could be as light as walking, it could be stretching, it could be yoga, but it has to be something. And that's just going to create a brainwave to always stay physically fit. But when I made the switch, I basically just did this. I just cut a lot of my cardio out or down significantly, because that was like the big thing. That was a big calorie burner. It was also a big muscle burner, because I was so low in body fat percentage. I was just eating my muscle mass, I look at old pictures and video footage, and my arm is just like a bone with a ball of bicep here, and then like striations in my arm. I kind of look like something out of one of those Batman movies or Superman movies, one of the evil people or whatever. And I was really, really... just like muscle, bone, and striations. However, it just didn't look right. I looked unhealthy. So I just turned the switch very slowly, and I turned the volume up slowly, and I started weaning out the mass amounts of exercise, and I only worked out maybe like an hour and a half a day at first. And then eventually it just got down to like an hour, and then I completely just transitioned over to weights for a while and did like light cardio and stuff like that. And as I started gaining weight back, I just started feeling better. It was like my brain was like the biggest thing that was bothering me. Because I was, like I said, it was on edge all the time, up and down, up and down. And then once I started including more calories and starting allowing more fat in my body, and I know all about fats, I know how beneficial they are and everything, but at that time I was like, fats are the most calorie dense of the three macronutrients, so I got to keep my fat intake low. And I was like, low fat this and no fat that. I wasn't buying low fat stuff. I just wasn't eating food with a lot of fat in it, for example. So it was, yeah, it was just like a gradual weaning out of like the long high intensity workouts. And I just kind of came back to like basics, and I started doing more like compound exercises and more weight training that's going to be more conducive to putting on bulk and mass. So that's what I did. I just kind of slowly did it, though. And like I said, it literally took me a year and a half to get comfortable with that.
Yeah, so, okay, look, you know, I said at the top of the show, you know, that I believe, you know, out of every adversity comes somebody's purpose. Matter of fact, oftentimes the bigger the adversity, you know, the bigger the calling, the bigger the adversity, the better someone actually becomes. And I see, it's been my life, and I see it in your life, Kevin. You know, it's you're an amazing trainer. I mean, I've been in the gym my whole life, you know, so I can see the guys who are really doing some unique work, you know, and doing some great work. And I saw that about you. So when my wife approached me and said, you know, well, actually, to be honest with you, I had been encouraging her to get a trainer. You know, she always does the same thing in the gym, and I'm always like, you got to mix it up. I don't know. She was one of those people. I said, you know, you need a trainer. You know, you really do. You need someone to take you to the next level. Well, who should I get? I said, that guy right over there. And
a tall, bald guy over there.
There's a lot of trainers. Look, we live in Park City, Utah. I mean, Kevin had said it somewhere in the show here that we probably live in the most fit community in the United States of America. Kevin, would you agree with that? Yeah.
It's actually, I believe it's been documented that Summit County, which we live in, is the fittest county in the United States. I heard that at a talk I went to, and I do believe it's true.
Yeah, we joke and say, is he a one sport a day person or a three? Meaning, they go out, they bike, they run, they hike, or they ski.
Swim.
I mean, literally, three sports a day. I mean, the people around here, you know, they can pull it off. Typically, they're young entrepreneurs, and they're their lifestyle somehow. But anyways, so, you know, there's a lot of great trainers. And I said, there's the guy, you know. I mean, I could tell you knew what you're doing. So, you know, with that said, obviously it evolved into some amazing stuff. I mean, you know, you take that intensity and you put it into something good now. And, you know, obviously you're over that. I mean, I maybe you never get over it. Maybe it's like alcoholism. Could you fall back in it? Let me start with that question. That's a really good question. I said you're over it because I'm looking at you. I see you change it.
Yeah, it's something you have to fight every day.
Yeah, I mean, do you still struggle with some of those thoughts, man? I mean, does this come back in your head?
It's a daily struggle. I definitely wanted to touch on that point before we closed out on orthorexia, because it's once you have it, it's kind of like celiac disease, or it's like alcoholism. You have it, it's with you 24 hours a day, and it's always in the back of your head chirping at you. Mm. And it's like you get a bad day, or you get something bad happens, and you immediately start gritting your teeth, and you start clenching your fists, and you're like, and you want to do like this long workout, and you want to jump on the bike, and you want to go for miles. And then it's almost like your head just kind of starts going back in that direction of, I'll show them, I'll do this, or I'll do that, and I'll get extra ripped or extra lean. But then the difference is I now have it in more control, where I can stop myself and say, wait, stop. And then I think back of what happened and where I came from and who I would be disappointing if I went back to 145 pounds again. And I don't know if I'd make it out this time if I went back down there. And I think of the long-term ramifications, and I'm able to stop. I'm basically able to control it now. Is it gone? No, it's never going to be gone, ever. Because I go to a party, and I see cake, and I see all these things, and one of the telltale signs of orthorexia is you start sorting things out as soon as you get to a party, or if you're invited to someone's house for dinner, and you start making alterations to your meal. Like, if someone says, oh, I'm going to have pork loin for dinner, you start automatically, your brain starts thinking, I wonder how it's prepared, I wonder if it's in butter, if it's coconut oil, if it's got grease, if it's got sauce, if it's got marinade, if it has gluten, if it has high fructose corn syrup, if they have organic, if it's not organic, is it hormone-free? And all these thoughts just go and swirl. So it's always there. It never leaves. However, I'm more accepting now that of when people cook me a meal, I'm not gonna pick it apart like I used to. I'm gonna be very accepting of it, and I'm very flattered that someone go out of their way to prepare a meal for me, because it's more important to have food on the table and survive than it is to have nothing. And there's so many people who do have nothing or scrap even more than me, and I'm like, I feel selfish at times to even think about my little situation of, oh, does that have high fructose corn syrup or GMOs in it? So it's always there. It's a daily battle, but I have it in control now. And I just had my oatmeal this morning, but I have systems set in place. You know, I gotta have a certain amount of this and a certain amount of that, and I make it and whatever, and that's the end of the story. And my eating habits they're still pretty rigid, but I eat more calories, obviously, now, or I wouldn't be able to gain as much weight as I have. And I have it dialed in a lot better now, and I'm in more control. But you never healed.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. Because of this, I mean, could you train for a triathlon or an Ironman, or would that set you off on a pattern?
I probably wouldn't do it just because I can't stand the idea of swimming that far and long. It's like I swim one lap in a pool really gracefully, and then halfway through the second one, I'll just die, and I'll be like, oh, my God, get me out of this pool. I probably could do it, but I would be approached with caution. I don't know, David. That's a good question. I never really did think about that.
My feeling on that is don't do it.
Yeah.
When David asked the question, I thought to myself, yeah, I think that's a bad idea for you. Yeah.
Yeah. It might be. It might just be a bad idea.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I asked the question because there's people who are listening that may be going through the same thing, and they all of a sudden someone challenges them to do an Ironman. What does that mean? Does it set them back off? I mean, who knows? Yeah,
I think it's a great question, but I think it's like an alcoholic to the bar, you know? I don't know. That's good, yeah. You know, that's an odd thing. Yeah, I mean, you know.
I think that would be case-dependent, to be honest with you.
Yeah, you're probably right. But anyway, so here's the thing. Look, I mean, it's like, to me, like, I know you struggle with it every day, but, you know, intellectually, you go, okay, 195 pounds at 6'3", 6'4", I look better. Why the heck would I want to go back down to 145? You know what I'm saying? I mean, doesn't your brain just sort it out that way? It's like, my gosh, I mean, I look so much better. Of course I'm going to stay with this. Well, I would never do that.
Honestly, I think the weight is an afterthought until you start losing the weight. Because at first it wasn't about the weight. It was about lean and ripped. You know, for me it was like, oh, I want to get lean and ripped like Bruce Lee, because Bruce Lee's one of my all-time favorite people in the world. And I'm like, oh, he was 3.5% body fat. I can get the 3.5% body fat, no problem. And you know what? If you went back in 1968, 1970, and before he died, and analyzed Bruce Lee's lifestyle, you'd probably find out he had a massive eating disorder as well.
I was thinking of that.
Yeah. So, great guy. Loved him to death. However, it became my fixation in life. Because, I mean, as David was saying before, when I was growing up, I was like, I want to be a professional wrestler. I got to get her. I got to gain weight. It was all about gaining weight back in the day when I was in high school and stuff. And then like early college years, early 20s and stuff like that. But I found out that I'm not designed to gain mass amounts of weight. And I'm not going to do steroids because that's ridiculous. So I'm like, well, what other options do I have? Then I realized, oh, you know what? I'm broad shoulders, tall, lean. I got more of like a fitness model type body. So let me just exploit that. So then I started doing, I did it one summer and I'm like, oh, I really like this, you know, lean cut type physique that I'm building here, and I'm just going to stick with that from now on out. So basically, it just started like that, and I just kind of exploited my strengths. And I always tell people, try to work on your strengths, and that's what I did. And I just took it too far, because then all the old things started rolling in from like when I was 5 on the way up, and like being emotional that I am and being like attached to certain things. So it all just kind of culminated and added all together into what it became.
Well, yeah, we really appreciate you sharing that story. You know, I mean, we have so many healthy people that, you know, follow us, so... You know, maybe they should reach out to you. You know, I don't know how they could reach out to you, but, you know, offer your website, whatever you feel comfortable offering, that someone who's watching this that's going, oh, my God, that's me, you know, how do we reach out to you, Kevin?
You can find me on Facebook, first of all, at just Kevin Rail, SRAIL. Secondly, you can look at my website at actofnutrition.com. That's active, not active, nutrition.com. You can also shoot me an email at krail@wellcoaches.com. That's krail@wellcoaches.com.
Hey, someone, write that email down and hold it up. People get all, you know, you give them too many things. Yeah, I really, if someone's out there struggling with this, I really want them to reach out to you, man. I mean, and not that you're the end-all solution for
them. I got his website here, so we can put it right up here.
Oh, cool.
Actofnutrition.com. Is that correct?
Yep, that is. And my contact info is on there as well.
Okay. Actofnutrition.com, if anyone can read my handwriting.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, again, not that you're their end-all answer, right? But, you know, at least you can – I think reaching out to someone that's experienced it is the first step, you know, and
absolutely.
That could be the first step, and then, you know, go from there. But, you know, so thank you so much for sharing that. But I promised this at the top of the show that I mean, you know, out of that comes great things, you know, and that was my point earlier. You know, it's like you're an amazing trainer. I mean, you do some stuff that I believe is so important, you know, as far as exercise goes. Number one, I talk about diet variation on the show and how important that is and how that works with our adaptation and, you know, but exercise variation. I mean, every time I see you with someone that you're doing different things, nobody varies exercise like you. But I'm also an understanding of how the nerve system works, you know, with exercise. And neuromuscular load, neuromuscular reeducation is something that I use to fix spines in my early days as a structural correction specialist, right? I watch what you do. I mean, you've kind of put a lot of these things together. So just kind of give them a quick thing of what you do and why it's so different than the average workout program.
Well, the way I see exercise, it shouldn't be about how much you can bench press and how much you can squat and how much you can deadlift and how much you can weight you can lift to impress your friends. All those movements are fine and dandy, but they're very linear. They're like one motion. Like biceps curler, for example, all you're doing is flexing your arms. It's like drinking a beer. It's boring, first of all. And yeah, it's going to build your bicep, but so what? It's a showboat muscle. Look at those guns poking through the shirt. Awesome. But in life, you're going to be doing flexion all day long with bottles and stuff like that. Big deal. Big whoop. That's no big deal. Anybody can do it. In reality, your body is more like a glob moving around the earth, because you're always moving in circular patterns and three-dimensional movement patterns. Whether you're biking or where you're running or scaling a hill or rock climbing or getting groceries out of a car or putting a toddler in a crib or situating rocks in your garden, you're always moving around in a three-dimensional type pattern in a three-dimensional way. So why wouldn't you want to improve your fitness ability to improve your abilities with all the stuff of daily living that you're doing outside the gym? That's the key thing. So what I do is I focus on strengthening the body in a way that's going to help you with all the activities that you do outside the gym, because that's where your love and passion is anyway. And when I start training someone for the first time, I don't just like say, oh, meet me at the gym and whatever. I say, why don't you meet me at the gym lobby first? And I have the consultation, which I like to call an interview. I literally interview people before I train them. And if I don't feel there's chemistry or I don't feel I'm a good fit for them, I won't take them on as a client. I want to know what they do outside the gym. I'm like, what makes you happy? What do you do outside the gym? Well, I play tennis and I swim and I do triathlons and all these other things. And I want to make sure that my strength levels are up and so on and so forth. I'm like, good. So you told me you run, you bike, you swim, and you play tennis, all of which are rotational movement pattern exercise or motions. For a repetitive amount of time. So what I do is I collect all the data from what they're looking to do. I calculate what injuries they have and what they can't do, and then I formulate workouts based on what's going to improve their capacity with all those things they do outside the gym, whether it's a rock climber or a rugby player or whatever. And then I build my workouts around that. So I think about the movement patterns that they do, and then I think about how I can apply that to exercise movement patterns. And then I either create them on my own or I just kind of put combinations together of different movement patterns, and what I like to call three-dimensional movements that have a lot of neurological load, as you call it, neuroscience something. You referenced to it before. So something that has a lot of neurological load means that you have to think a lot when you're doing what you're doing. So a lot of things I do involve cross-body motions of the arms and legs. For example, a log roll with a push-up is something you do in a plank position on the ground, and then you lift your one arm in the air so your body forms like a T. Then you do a complete reverse plank. You put your hand on the ground, then you roll all the way back around to the other side, and you go right into a push-up, and you pop back up, and then you roll the other direction. So you've just done a three-dimensional movement pattern where you go complete log roll plus a push-up. So you're working pretty much your entire core, your chest, your arms, your legs, all rolled into one movement pattern. And that's just one little small piece. Then sometimes I'll add a walk-down where you start from a standing position, then you do a squat, then you put your hands on the ground, walk out, do a push-up, then do a log roll, do another push-up, walk back up, walk back down. So that's like, I call it a series or a journey. So you're doing like a whole series of movement patterns back and forth like this in a beautiful, graceful motion. And it's not just all the core muscles are working and the chest and the back, and you're getting all this muscle recruitment, but you're also getting a high amount of neurological load because you've got to think to yourself, what am I doing next? So I've got to lower myself down. I've got to think about the position of my hands and my arms and my legs. Put your hands on the ground a certain way. You walk forward a certain way with your hands. Then you roll a certain way. You've got to keep your hips up. And you have to be thinking about it the whole time as you're exercising. So what that does is it also improves your neurological load as well, meaning it improves your brain function. So I like to enrich the function of the brain as well as the body when I do exercise, for personally and with people that I train, because I want people to be not only physically fit, but I want them to be mentally fit as they age and as they get older, and it doesn't matter what the age is. If they play a sport It's very good to improve your concentration and your mental ability. So that's kind of where I come in with it, the whole exercise thing. That's my take on it. And that's going to improve every aspect. And another thing that's really good about that is kids that are in middle school up through high school, we've lost touch with PE, as you are well aware. And what, the biggest aspect that's missing is there's no PE class, and if it is, it's pretty lame. So if they learn these movement patterns where they have to think about the position of their hands and their feet and they're crossing the midline of their body, the right brain, left hemisphere and right hemisphere of the brain are constantly working. So it actually improves test scores and it improves brain function. So I try to bring all this together. I have clients of all ages, and I make sure that my high school age clients do a lot of this three-dimensional type movement patterns. That has a lot of neurological load.
Yeah, sorry. Something kicked on here behind me. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's all right.
Thank you. Yeah, so I had a question. One thing is people, are, you know, you went through these movements. On your website, do you have video of that? Do you have, some videos that people can watch? Because, you know, hearing you do it, they're like, okay, can they go to your website?
I'm about to start building the video library as we speak, doing some test runs right now, and I'm going to be adding them all into YouTube and stuff. They're going to be available through either YouTube or Vimeo. I'm not quite sure yet, but I'm going to start adding all that stuff in the upcoming year, starting this summer.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, that would be, amazing. Look, I can tell you this right now. I mean, it had such a transformation effect on my wife. I mean, it really did.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of her neuromuscular stuff was off. I mean, you know, she really never did sports as a kid. And, you know, so you're right. The linear motions, you know, helped her to a point. You know, but really, a lot of your work, you know, really has, you know, transformed her. Even as an athlete, the difference of her on a bike this year versus the year before have been, you know, amazing. I actually threw her keys, the other day. It was like, wham! She nailed it. I was like, okay, that would have, like, bounced off your head in the past, you know? I mean, I can just see functionally how much better she is. And, of course, you know, her physique has also changed, so... You know, it's you do amazing work, Kevin. You really do.
Okay.
And again, it doesn't surprise me that type of amazing work, you know, came out of your adversity. I mean, you have your six things here. We have to wrap the show up, but you have these six things that you talk about, these motions, right? I mean, tell us a little bit about that.
The six things?
Yeah, it was like these six things you gave my wife. She comes home and tells me all these things, right? And it was... The six ways the body moves, or six movements, or six...
Oh, yes. Okay, so basically the body has six postures. That's what it was.
That's
so you've got vertical, which is standing up. You've got horizontal, which is lying on your stomach or back. You've got flexion, which is bending forward, which is flexion of the spine. You have extension, which is going the other way. And then you've got brachiation, which is hanging from a bar. And then you've got inversion, which is hanging upside down from a bar. So when I train her, that's another thing. I try to keep... all those postures in mind when I train people. And,
and the
key thing is, if you can work out each one of your workouts, you should try to get as many of those postures involved with your workouts as you can. And that's going to create the closest thing to a superhuman as you can find. It's going to create a nice, flexible, supple, strong body with a strong core. And there's no two ways around it if you keep those principles in mind.
Yeah.
So one of the things I love to do is hanging from a bar. Like, the true definition of brachiation is swinging from, like, limb to limb or branch to branch like a monkey. That's the true definition of brachiation. But just hanging from the bar is counted as brachiation as well. And when you hang from a bar, you can reset your shoulders and you can reset your spinal column and stuff. And if people that sit at a desk all day, they'd have rounded shoulders like this. The best therapy they can do is just grab a bar and hang from it for 15 seconds a day to start out.
I agree.
It's a simple thing, you know?
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, it's when she came in and told me that, I'm like, yeah, that's all true, because we used to utilize that in spinal correction. You know, it's a lot of the same principles, and something neuromuscular reeducation is the key. You know, you're reeducating the nerves, the muscles, you know, to really adapt a new position. So at the end of the day, you're like this all day. You know,
exactly.
If you don't do anything to neuromuscular recorrect.
Are you talking about hanging like this, or are you hanging upside down?
No, hang. So brachiation is just hanging from a bar. And then inversion would be flipped over upside down, hanging from a bar with inversion boots on.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's the difference.
Yeah.
So,
well, Kevin, man, I hope a lot of people go to your website, you know, and just see what you're up to, because, you know, it's amazing stuff. I mean, obviously, you're changing lives because your life was changed. And we so appreciate you sharing your story. I mean, it does. It always takes a lot of guts you know, to just talk about, you know, what we've been through. But I believe it is the adversity that makes the man, and it makes you, man. There's no doubt. You'd never be able to affect the people you affect if you didn't go through that. So
I appreciate it. Thanks, Dan.
I learned something in Africa. When I was there, they had a saying, and he says, you know, you're basically your authority in life, and whatever you're in, it comes from the victory God gave you, you know, in your adversity. You know, so it's not all the study. It's not all the things that we think it is. It's the victory God gives us. It is from the adversity that our authority comes from, and you move and walk in that authority, you know, no doubt, Kevin, because of your adversity. So thank you for that.
I appreciate it, and I would like to say it's been a pleasure being on the show today, and I really appreciate the opportunity. And, yeah. And if you, any of you out there have any questions at all, if you even think you know, you may have an eating disorder or situation, or you know someone who does, just please feel free to reach out to me. And if you forgot my contact info, just contact Dan and he'll get it to you ASAP.
Yeah. Actofnutrition.com. Thank you, Kevin.
Yep. You got it.
The information shared on today's show can be accessed through our websites, drpompa.com and revelationhealth.com. This Cellular Healing TV episode and past shows are also available for download on iTunes. Help others get real health solutions by liking, reviewing, and sharing our podcasts.